Once you had a glimpse, there's no way to turn back. No way. Big self. Big Zuko. Forever. Almanac.
Almanac.
Forever. Almanac.
Hello there, Jackfruit and Jillfruit, and welcome to yet another dick exploding, vagina imploding. I apologize for the crassness, but that's what our latest listener reports have indicated, and we hope Jeremiah Baranos and Tanya Lyman are recovering nicely. But another dick-exploding, vagina-imploding episode of Big Zuko's Forever Almanac, a chronicle of reminiscences. I, without hesitation, am your faithful leader through this twisted psyche, as well as acting as your arch-Zook to all things Bic. Actually, I should probably clarify, I'm only your arch-Zook on Bic Zuko-related matters. Anything on the Bic pens, I'm pretty clueless on. Pretty, really clueless. I digress, though. I received some interesting mail today. It, to begin with, was interesting because it was actually sent through the air and delivered by a person rather than the data dragons that fly emails hither and thither within their realm known as the internet. No, this was actual mail that was asking if I was interested in joining the J.J. Abrams Writer's Room Fantasy Camp again this year. Let me back up. J.J. Abrams started a writer's room fantasy camp where you mirrored the actions and activities of one of his writer's rooms, while he and actual writers help you develop and break simulated storylines. This fantasy camp originally started in Alias's Nader, interestingly enough, as a last-ditch effort to regain profits and offset losses from the hemorrhaging, flailing show, but then found newfound life once Lost began, obviously, since everyone was loving Lost, and everyone was clamoring for Abrams at this point. It's worth mentioning that when the fantasy camp shifted to focus on Lost, the Jennifer Garner swimwear spyware pageant component of camp was unfortunately no longer featured. I had signed up for this Writer's Room Fantasy Camp specifically in the Fringe division. I had done tremendous work on Fringe fantasy stories, had rewatched the series in preparation, and was absolutely convinced I would be the best one there. But as the date rolled closer, I was told that the Fringe camp had egregiously filled, and I would have to take part in the Revolution camp. Revolution was a show I had never seen before, and never looked particularly interesting to me, but I agreed to this and thought it would still be worth it. Still riding on the emotions of my previous fantasy camp mentality, I accordingly did no prep work on Revolution or even bothered to watch any of the episodes. I prepared for Fringe. It wasn't my fault that Fringe was full, so why should I have to adapt or take a back seat? In fact, my work on Revolution would probably be so amazing, they'd likely bump me into the Fringe camp. Yeah, I thought, I'll even write the next 100 Watts of Darkness, which I assume is the title of Revolution's best episode, but of course cannot be sure of, never having seen the show. The strategy I'd adopted was not the right one. I was a failure at fantasy camp. I stood out, I fumbled, I second-guessed everything I did, while not listening to the useful advice preservers that were thrown my way, and I couldn't keep any of the characters straight. I brought up Fringe once, and was told to shut the fuck up. I brought up Fringe a second time, and when I returned from the bathroom, the script that I was working on had been replaced with child pornography. Necrophilia-based child pornography. I couldn't even pitch a successful B story out of the group, and at the end of the day, Fringe showrunner J.H. Wyman wouldn't even look at me. And when I asked Jeff Pinkner if he knew what time it was, he pretended that he didn't hear me. But I know that he did. I got swept up in the delusion that I'd be the star of the camp, and if I was just normal and went in with realistic, open expectations, I probably would have made a positive impression or at least had a good time. And as I look at this mail and think back to this spoiled experience, I can't help but recall a similar page out of Zuko's book, The Forever Almanac, of course, where he too danced with delusion under the hot, hot California sun, in a story titled, Happily Ever, Before and After. My heavy eyes adjusted to the weak lighting in my room. One of the bulbs needed to be changed, as they eventually deciphered the name Zaxby glowing up at me from my phone. Zaxby. That was a name I hadn't seen in years, assuming, of course, that this was Broden Zaxby, which it had to be, because this world is just too small for two random people named Zaxby to be entering my life. And my name's already Zuko. Broden Zaxby was my writing partner in the earliest stages of my career. We wrote The Hiroshima Syndrome, Buttons and Bows, and Are You Now or Have You Ever Been a Member of the Lycanthropy Party? He was my Marshall Brickman or Roger Avery, and much like Marshall Brickman or Roger Avery, Broden Zaxby had faded into obscurity after we parted ways, until he became popular for having his name flash on my phone early in the morning. I answered my phone, and immediately from the timbre of Broden's voice, I could already tell that he had fallen on harsh times, and didn't need to hear him verbalize as such as a confirmation. Broden was struggling, but it was nice to hear his voice again, comforting even. Flashes of sentence fragments from the works we wrote together surged through my consciousness as I listened to Broden catch me up to speed. Essentially, what he needed of me was a ride to Los Angeles. In under usual circumstances, a double-digit hour road trip would simply not be happening, but I saw this as an opportunity to bond with an old friend. I was the best man at Broden's wedding, after all. Before the divorce. And try to connect with my roots and get out of my head. I hadn't had the best of luck lately in terms of finding a new project to occupy my time with, and in the long hours of the night that saw me staring at a blank word processing screen, I cursed the city of New York and swore that all of my writing peccadilloes and problems were due to the angry drone that the bird gave off. So I told Broden that I'd accompany him to the West Coast. I even knew a few literary contacts over there that always warned me to look them up if I was ever in town, and I was eager to take them up on this. Maybe even this act of Samaritarianism would bear fruit. Work fruit. Well-paying work fruit. The wheels of my burgundy 96 Toyota Corolla hit the highway and we made roads into our journey, the two of us sitting in a lengthy silence initially, looking just like we were when we were on our way to pitch the Hiroshima Syndrome to Marigold Publishing. Only a frenzied chaos occupied Broden's eyes now. He'd read the license plates of all the cars in front of us out loud, but with so little awareness towards the gesture, I was unable to tell if Broden was doing this purposefully or if it was the result of some newly formed anxiety tic. 027 WRJ 812 RES 119 B47. While on the phone with Broden originally, he did reveal why this exodus was happening, what his plan was, but it wasn't until we were deep on the road that he really allowed himself to open up on the matter. Broden wanted to be on Wheel of Fortune as a writer. That's right, the reason why Broden and I were traveling hundreds of miles across the country was so he could hopefully become a writer for Wheel of Fortune. And in case you're wondering, no, there is not some new dramatic series airing on an edgy, aggressive cable network called Wheel of Fortune about a corrupt judge starring Malcolm McDowell. No, this is the same tired game show with Pat Sajak and Vanna White in blue-collar podunk America that my friend wanted to write for. And if I didn't believe him, which seemed like a silly thing for him to say at this point, as we were already in the car en route, but if I didn't believe him, then I could look at his packet as he gestured to the backseat of the Corolla. Hell, it was even endorsed by game show host Carter Castanet himself. It wasn't until Broden and I had stopped at our first way station, a Zaxby's, which coincidentally is a food chain that has nothing to do with Broden and his last name, Zaxby. Believe me, he's looked into it, deeply, and all it is coincidence. But it wasn't until we were stopped at this Zaxby's that I had time to go over Broden's Wheel of Fortune packet. I waited until he was in the bathroom, so as to leave myself a modicum of self-preservation. And when I opened the packet up, all I saw were two pieces of paper, both with a single phrase written in bold, 22-point New Courier font in the middle of the pages. The first said, Jeffrey Tambourine Man. The second, James Mason Jar. That was it. Panic washed over me in what I knew could only be 2 more minutes maximum before Broden returned. This wasn't a packet. This was barely anything. Do they even do packets at Wheel of Fortune in the first place? And even if they did, if these examples were any indication of Broden's work, then he was hardly the next Rod Serling of game show writing. These were presumably supposed to be samples for Wheel of Fortune's popular before and after category, where portmanteau-esque mashups of words are put together to form new phrases, such as, What's up, dude ranch? Or, Wheel of Fortune cookie. However, Jeffrey Tambourine Man isn't even technically a proper example. It combines tambour and tambourine into one word and doesn't traditionally work. If you broke it up, Jeffrey Tambourine wouldn't stand on its own or mean anything. James Mason Jar worked, but the less said on it, the better. When Broden returned, he asked if I had looked at his packet, and I told him I'd cover the meal to change the subject. He seemed happy. Many days later, Broden and I began to see palm trees slowly crop up amongst our path, and we had finally reached Los Angeles. Broden, myself, and this dilapidated vehicle now merged into one supreme being of closeness and travel, and in spite of any initial reservations I had towards Broden, and all the current reservations I had towards his packet, we had actually fallen back into old rhythms and were very comfortable right now. We even plotted out a Rush sequel to Are You Now or Have You Ever Been a Member of the Lycanthropy Party that saw protagonist Lou Guru in the Senate. Admittedly, a sloppy, foolish sequel, but a sequel all the same. All it took was being locked in a car together for umpteen hours. I'd been able to coordinate a few meetings with potential publishers, and after Broden and I had settled, that is what I had planned to fill my day with. And even if these meetings didn't work out creatively, I figured I should still be fairly drunk from all of the business cocktails once the day is through. At this point, I hailed a taxi and headed north, and Broden and I split ways. Now, everything that follows is an accurate account of what transpired on Zaxby's End. He, in fact, not actually coming clean to me about what actually happened here until many years later, though. And then, the honesty just spilled forth like poison. But please remember that I was not there, and rather that all of this happened only to Zaxby. Broden, having the day free to himself while I saw meetings, decided that the best use of his time was to bolster his confidence in this new city so he could wow the room in his Wheel of Fortune meeting. As Broden pontificated on the best ways to achieve this, he found himself wandering aimlessly into the Inland Empire, with no concept of where he was. Soon, all the familiar landmarks and set dressings of downtown LA began to be replaced with prostitutes. And more prostitutes. By the time Broden realized that he was lost, he was already too busy getting lost in the legs of a red-headed streetwalker named Cherry Bomb. Now, it's worth clarifying that the bomb in Cherry Bomb is spelled B-A-U-M rather than B-O-M-B, or even the less common but still entirely valid B-A-L-M, bomb word. This was certainly a confusing situation that didn't seem to be born out of ignorance, for at one point during the day, Broden saw her send a text message to a fellow love slinger that said, "Really bombed last night. B-O-M-B-E-D. Ugly stuff." So clearly she knew how to spell bomb correctly, which begged the question that this other bomb, B-A-U-M, she was using, meant something else entirely in her eyes, and was the answer to some prostitute riddle that may never be unlocked. But I may have just thrown out the baby with the bathwater here. Yes, Broden talked up Cherry Bomb, and it wasn't long until he was bolstering his confidence with her behind a rusty dumpster in an alleyway. He bolstered his confidence all over her impressively optimistic, cold sore ridden face, freckles and cold sores adorning her in near symmetry, like dates to a dance. Broden held Cherry's waist as he fucked her from behind. The condoms he brought with him concealed away in the crumpled trousers around his ankles. Wheel of Fortune writers didn't use condoms. Pat Sajak didn't use condoms. Vanna White didn't like men who used condoms. They were all a part of the bareback club now, and oh, wasn't it sweet. Broden tugged at Cherry's red hair that looked less real every second he looked at it, and when she looked back at him and said, "I have age," Broden just responded with, "You're not that old, honey, and if you have age, then I guess I'm a fan of age, too." And then continued to bump and buckle. Broden watched a raccoon unwrap a Zaxby's hamburger in the distance and a fellow call girl nab a man right before he ejaculated. As Broden and Cherry Bomb were cleaning themselves up and the raccoon in the distance was three-quarters done his burger, Broden told Cherry what he was here to do in LA, and she nearly had another orgasm right on the spot. Cherry explained that she worked on the cable access show Wheel of Fuction, which was pretty much Wheel of Fortune, except she, the Vanna White character, was topless the entire program. And all the answers were sex-based. Jeffrey Tambourine Man might have not been the best fit in their foreplay and afterglow category. But regardless, Cherry Bomb was convinced that if she could meet Vanna White and watch her work in real life, that it would definitely help her with her own work and let her perfect the art of letter turning. And so, she asked to join Broden on his journey. Broden, caught up in Cherry's own afterglow, allowed her to join him. Broden and Cherry didn't make it far through the alley until they heard a bellowous, "Excuse me! Where do you think you're going? I know I ain't seen you creeping away. As Broden turned around, he saw three large and... Actually, large is really the perfect only word to describe these she-lummoxes masquerading as sex workers. Churi would later tell Broden that these women's names, and the word names is used loosely, as their monikers were just as much punctuation as they were letters, but their names were Ladasha, Dapostrophe, and Glampersand. And they collectively were her pimps. We ain't been running Troy like some ratchet raggedy asshole. And let us be real for a second, okay? And ask yourself, what you gonna do if you ain't slanging for us? And even if that pea brain had an answer, we own you, bitch. And we don't see a free woman. We just see a dick slave. Broden looked at Cherry, not knowing what to do. But she did, and immediately began walking towards the troika of women, her arms outstretched, reaching for a hug. Her face defeated, knowing that this is her rightful place, and returning to her slot in the order, accepting the warm embrace of submission. And just as the four of them were about to complete their hug, Cherry jutted her arm across them all swiftly. Almost in unison, blood began hissing out of the throats of the three prostitutes, Ladasha's throat having the thinnest of slits across the jugular as her knees slowly gave out. Glampersand down on the cold pavement already, her throat looking in much the same shape, and Apostrophe flailed wildly at the brick wall beside her, her legs swinging round as she would frantically lose her balance to only nearly immediately regain it. The cut on her was on the side of her neck, and not nearly as severe. Blood still sprayed, and Apostrophe was clearly taken aback, but before she attempted to figure out what was happening, Cherry was already right back at her and finished the job. She waved at Broden as she walked back, the sun catching the razor blade beneath her pointer finger's nail, the universe giving away her concealed weapon, as if it hadn't already been figured out by now. Broden and Cherry moved on from the murder scene, her heels leaving a faint trail of blood behind them on the dark ground until they didn't. It wasn't until this moment that the realization hit Brody, but the adrenaline rushing through his body managed to suppress it down inside of him, that earlier, when he and Cherry were having sex, she wasn't saying, "I have age." She was saying, "I have AIDS." Before we went to the Wheel of Fortune Studios, Cherry said it was an essential stop to go visit L Street, a heroin dealer. The best, most fair heroin dealer, according to Cherry. And while impromptu injections was not a regular part of Broden's diet, it seemed like the smartest idea at the time, as a means of coping with the recent information he had come in contact with, as well as a solid way of keeping that confidence bolstered all the way through to this meeting. L Street looked exactly like the kind of guy that Dapostrophe or Clamperson would date, but not Ladasha. You know what I mean? It's really a shame that you're at the disadvantage of never having seen them, and therefore not knowing what L Street looks like, but rest assured, whatever image in your head you have for heroin dealer is likely applicable here. Whatever you're thinking is right. It wasn't until Broden and Cherry were tied off and feeling the kick when Broden noticed L Street's shrewd business sense with some other prospective clients. L Street was smart. For instance, he wouldn't let some stranger take advantage of him. Instead, he'd just stab the stranger and then suddenly have the respect and attention of said stranger that he expected to have in the first place. Because of this eagle eye for business acumen, Broden thought it would be wise to have L Street join them to the studio. He would make sure he didn't get manipulated by the network suits and broker him a winning deal. L Street, while initially hesitant to spend his day traveling behind a honky and some busted-ass hoe, decided to come along when considering the number of high-class network contacts they'll be encountering that would have the highly expendable income to purchase his product. But before four footprints could become six and be off on their way, a shaky paper-white man in a wrinkled suit that seemed to fold into the crevices of his skin, every fold a worried, furrowed brow on his body, cleared his throat and made his presence known. He had apparently been standing with us the entire time, but nobody had noticed him. The crumpled ball of paper of a man was a disgraced accountant by the name of Frank Withers Balk, a name that was so self-deprecating on this already sad man, Broden didn't understand why he didn't just shorten it to Frank Balk, or even Frank W.B. Frank stuttered out that he could contribute to Broden's pitch too, and would be able to talk the numbers and finances that Broden couldn't. Sure, he was rusty, and his calculator had picked up a few dozen scuff marks throughout the years, but by God, he was an accountant, and that would never change, Frank shouted as he finished pulling the heroin needle out of his tired vein. Frank just hoped to find some relevancy and steady work again at the end of the day. With no one having a clear head amongst them, which made it seem like all of them were thinking on the level, Frank Withers Balk joined L Street, Cherry Bomb, and Broden Zaxby as they all headed to the Wheel of Fortune offices to present their case. At this point, I felt it was necessary to point out that I, not Broden, but I, Bic Zuko, at this point in the story, had just had the most delicious meal of sushi that I've ever had in my life, at a place called Garden Sky Taste, right off of Glendale. This has nothing to do with anything else, won't come up again, and debatably destroys the flow of Broden's story that has been progressing nicely thus far. But when Broden was doing this, I was just about finishing my meal at Garden Sky Taste, and I thought that it should be known. Thank you. Back to Broden. The four of them entered the cavernous office and stood in cascading reverence as they approached the executive heads. Broden took a few apprehensive steps forward, and then a few more, and a few more. He, holding out his packet with fists clenched so tight, his wrists were nearly turning white. The two executives sitting behind the table accepted Broden's packet quizzically, and then eyed the rest of the occupants of the office even more quizzically. Broden nervously added, "I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Carter Castanet himself has endorsed and given this packet his blessing." The executives didn't even muster the energy to say "who?" to Broden. They both just languorously rose eyebrows and shifted their heads tilt angle. Broden continued, "You know, Carter Castanet, the host of Wheel of Fortune Jr., the automotive-based spin-off of Wheel of Fortune, but specifically for kids. My, I wish I could have gotten Donahue Spunk, the host of Wheel of Fortune, but I don't even know the first thing about how to go about contacting him. Yes, the host of Wheel of Fortune Jr. will hopefully suffice." Again, silence from the other side of the room, eyebrows risen further, heads angles more askew. A cough acted as an audible tumbleweed to break the silence. Perhaps it was due to seeing the struggling Broden flailing around hopelessly out of his league that willed the rest of his team into action. Or maybe their overwhelming want to succeed themselves and rise above the rest, not wanting this opportunity to elude them just because their leader was a crazy person. So as Broden rambled on about his worth and what he could offer to the Wheel of Fortune team, Cherry pranced around as eye candy in the background, primping and preening, arching and bending, turning imaginary letters around in the office while her varicose veins argued for real estate with track marks across her exposed skin. Meanwhile, Frank Withers-Bulk waxed on about numbers and figures that didn't really amount to anything, but he paced the room with conviction and pounded a sweaty fist down on the desk every couple dozen words to show to everyone in the room that he should be taken seriously and that he meant what he said. All the while, Elstree leaned against a wall, his eyes meticulously combing over both of the executives, and when their field of vision would wander over towards his, without missing a beat, he'd mouth to them,
"Uppers or downers, reds or blues, zips or zags,"
depending on the mannerisms of the executives. But he was always right, and they knew it. All of this continued to transpire and escalate in what felt like an increasingly small office as the pitch continued, one side responding with silence, and the other matching and raising that silence with unbridled ramblings. The symphony of insanity that was slowly entering its second movement throughout the Wheel of Fortune offices eventually ended, the four of them all simultaneously stopping at the same time, almost as if the spur-of-the-moment mess was actually a rehearsed and well-tweaked mess. They weren't given a definitive answer as they exited the offices, but any reader of body language would have easily observed, which is surprising that Elstree didn't pick up on this, that Broden's answer was a resounding no. The aftermath of the meeting was fairly anticlimactic, with all of them inevitably dispersing in different directions, like scavengers making off with the limbs of a carcass. Cherry Bomb had more clients to service, Elstree had more clients to service, and Frank Withers-Bulk? Well, Frank just wanted to be awake the next morning and be able to give his service. But as everyone left, their steps carried more weight, their shadows were cast with deeper gravitas, and their heads were all held high, erroneously thinking they were a part of something special this afternoon. I caught up with Broden a few hours later, right where we parted ways at the start of the day. I asked him how his meeting went and what his Los Angeles experience had resembled. I told him that my meetings had been a bust and no one was biting on what I'd been trying to feed them, but hey, the tan will be nice, and that hopefully he'd have had more luck than me. As we sat down in the Corolla together, putting on our seatbelts, Broden flashed me the biggest smile I'd ever seen him give, and he told me that his day had been the best day of his life, the biggest opportunity he's ever had, and that he wouldn't change a thing and do it all again exactly the same if he could. And I said good, and nodded my head and turned the ignition key, and Broden sat quietly on the drive home, knowing he now had HIV, and an itch for drugs that he doesn't have the financial means or emotional stability to afford. His life permanently stuck on the bankruptcy space, with all of the free spins and trips to Mexico's forever stripped from the wheel. And I looked at my friend and smiled, because he was smiling, but genuinely meaning it. Because a week ago, this person that was sitting next to me was out of my life entirely. But now I'm not only looking at them, but watching them thrive at the apex of their existence, who had the most admirable, courageous of goals, went for it, and his life is now all the better for it. He'll probably live forever. On the ride back, we tried to plot out a sequel to another of our previous works, Buttons and Bows, but failed in the process. Okay there, Roof Stoof. Am I right? Very curious what happened to Brode and Zaxby after all of that. My goodness. Also, believe me when I tell you that perhaps I can find the notes for Zuko's lycanthropy sequel that he mentioned in this chapter, and maybe even see if there's a way to publish it after all this time, or finish it off. But would you look at that, right? Delusion. All of them. And look where they ended up in the end. This is what I'm talking about, okay? I fixed my mistake, realized it before it was too late. And because of that, and those brave souls from this story, maybe I will actually sign up again with J.J. Abrams' Writer's Room Fantasy Camp this year in the Revolution Division. But this time, take it really seriously, even though I have no interest in the property. I have to get going, though. There's an episode of Wheel of Fortune coming on, and I'm feeling tremendous pangs of nostalgia pulling me to watch it. My eyes will carefully comb through the credits at the end of the program, hoping and praying to trick themselves into misreading someone else's name, anyone else's name, into Broden Zaxby. I'm Daniel Kurland, and this has been Bic Zuko's Forever Almanac, a Chronicle of Reminiscences, and until next time, the Chronicle is Chronic Closed.
Once you had a glimpse, there's no way to turn back. No way. But itself, Bic Zuko's Forever Almanac.
Forever Almanac.